ISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn. Is it only Tuesday? Wow, this week is dragging already, isn't it? Open talk to begin the program today. Our phone number is 283-2525. 283-2525. A little bit later, we're going to be chatting with Carol Havancik about a program called Care Packages for Veterans. So we'll chat with her for a little while. Also, do we need to teach our kids about kindness and compassion in today's society? We'll have a couple of guests who think that that's critically important. Dr. Dale Atkins and Amanda Salzhauer. They'll be visiting with us for a couple of minutes here later today. And then also today, it's Veterans Week. You know, we had Veterans Day. Well, we observed it yesterday. Actually occurred on Sunday. I'll be talking about an incident in World War II written about by Robert Fowler. Pretty interesting. And then also, while we're headed into the flu season, people are going to be more and more shut up indoors. Bad time for the flu, huh? We'll talk about our war against germs with Mark Olshaker. So we have a lot of guests. Some of them will be visiting with us for only a few minutes later on the program today. But we start out with Open Talk. 283-2525. I don't know of anybody personally who was actually diagnosed with the SAD, seasonally affective disorder. Do you know of anybody in your circle of friends or family who was actually diagnosed with it? I've read about it. I know it affects me, not to the point that I've, you know, got to get medication for it. At least I don't think so at this stage, but boy, oh boy, it affects me. Whenever the November weather, the lousy November weather really sets in, and boy, it has set in, hasn't it, over the past 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, it's been wet most of the year. We had a wet summer, we had a wet fall, but I'm talking about the colder temperatures. And we just don't seem to be able to get any relief. You know, out there right now, it's 37. Probably going to be the high for the day. At most, we might add another degree. And then down into the low 20s tonight. And a high tomorrow in the low 30s. That's about 20 degrees below normal. That's tough to take, isn't it? And it's just been miserable, you know, with the chilly rain and the wind and the dark, gloomy conditions. It definitely affects me. Now, I know there's some people who say they're tremendously affected by the time change when we go from daylight saving time back to standard time, which we did a little over a week ago. That never affects me too much because I seldom go to bed at exactly the same time anyway. But boy, SAD, seasonally affective disorder, that affects me a great deal. Really depressing, isn't it? Day after day like this, ugh. I may need help. Maybe our callers could supply it. 283-2525, the number Open Talk. Well, let's get to the people here today. Hi, caller. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Good afternoon, Dave. How are you doing?
Just fine. Nice to talk to you today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I have a question. I can't remember when you had it last year, the thing that you had down at Vagabond Building, Men Who Cook.
Yes.
And I was just wondering when that is coming up.
I believe in February. I haven't seen a final date yet, but that's when we've done it.
Okay.
For the past couple of years. We've done it for 2 years in a row now, and it's been in February, so.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody about it yesterday, and I'm like, maybe they don't have it till December or January, but it's February, huh?
That's when I think it's going to be. Again, I haven't seen any memos from the from upper management about that. We got a lot of things coming up here in the near future, you know, Butler Radio Group sponsors the Spirit of Christmas Parade downtown, and that's really kind of taking all of our energy right now, because that is a major undertaking, especially since we moved it to nighttime. You know, it makes it a little bit more difficult to get it all together.
Yeah, exactly. We really enjoyed ourselves last year at that Men Who Cook. And I don't know if you have anything to do with it, but I think it would be so nice if they gave us trays.
Okay.
They're having to try to carry a couple things at a time.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Yeah. Even a small tray would be nice, you know?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, because,
make a note
you know,
that,
you've got so many people up there, and if you can go up and get two or three or four things and then go back to your table and sit and eat and talk with your friends, and that makes it a lot easier.
I think it's a good idea. I will pass it on to upper management. How's that sound?
Oh, that sounds great. Thank you so much.
By the way, we have another event coming up, too, in early December. I don't have the fact sheet with me right now, but it's if you're a fan of Frank Sinatra, we've got Frank Sinatra Music Night coming up with Vince Tavolario, Vince Tavolario Trio. That's going to be first week or two in December. So that'll be a nice night, too. You might want to stay tuned for more details on that.
Okay, hey, you said first week of December.
I don't have the fact sheet with me. I want to say December 7th. Does that sound right? Pat Parker, do you know? I haven't seen the details yet, but we'll let you know as soon as they become available. Should be a fun night. We need fun things to do this time of year, you know?
Yes, we do. Yeah, I usually listen to the WISR quite a bit, so I'll keep my ears open.
Good to talk with you.
Okay, Dave, you have a good day.
And you too.
Stay warm.
Stay warm and try to keep smiling. I mean, it is chilly, but, you know, we dig out the heavier coats this time of year. I had to actually dig out the gloves a week or so ago. Always kind of hold off on that as long as possible. So that's nothing new, but it's, you know, it's the cold. It's the dreariness that gets me. You know, you look outside right now, and it's just, dark and dreary. Wow. Seasonally affective disorder. It affects me, that's for sure. 283-2525 is the number. I was reading an article in the Irish Times, which is the biggest newspaper in Ireland. I read it online. I don't get it, but no, I don't get it shipped to me. But I read it online, and there was a story that kind of piqued my interest. It was just a feature story of one of their writers, Jennifer O'Connell, said that she was just glancing through some old papers from, I guess it was from her mom, and a recipe fell out from her grandmother's cookbook. And I thought, yeah, that stirs some good memories for me. No question about it. Now, not my grandmother's cookbook, because of the circumstances of my family, I never really had grandmother. I had grandmothers, but I never knew them. They both died very, very young. My grandmother on my father's side died when my dad was only 5 years old, so I never knew them. But recipes in my mother's cookbook? Oh, yeah. And I think about them fondly this time of year as we head into the holidays. Good stuff, huh? Yeah. Back to the phones we go. It's Open Talk. The phone number is 283-2525. Hi there, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Dave, I have three questions maybe you can answer, or maybe your listeners can answer.
Should I put on my thinking cap? Okay, I'm ready to go here. I'll do my best.
Okay, the temple in downtown Butler, is it pronounced B'nai or B'nai?
It's B'nai.
Abraham.
B'nai.
Okay. Yeah,
B'nai
the
Abraham.
Second question. Mm-hmm. Second question, does it have a full-time rabbi?
It doesn't have a full-time rabbi. It has a cantor.
Well, that's not a rabbi. Anyway, the third question, is it conservative or reform?
That I do not know.
Okay, well, those are three questions.
No, there may be someone.
My curiosity goes back to my high school days when 4 nights a week I worked at the Squirrel Hill Theater in Squirrel Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And my boss was Jewish, one of the best bosses I ever had. And most of my coworkers, you know, the other ushers and the girls who worked at the candy counter were also Jewish. And so sort of by osmosis, I began to learn something, and I was a Catholic. And then I got an advanced course in college, also informal. Three of my classmates, one was Orthodox, one conservative, and one Reform, and I was Catholic, and we were interested in learning more about each other's religions, and so we would have these little bull sessions, you know, to kind of talk about it, and I really enjoyed those. So,
oh, that's wonderful. We all should be able to do that. You had a wonderful opportunity to do that.
Perfect.
Yeah. So what theater did you work in Squirrel Hill?
The Squirrel Hill Theater.
Oh, okay. I was trying to remember. When I was late teens, I think, I used to go to a movie down there occasionally. I want to say it was called The King's Court. Does that sound familiar?
No, the other.
Well, that was
Poor City neighborhood. It was kind of interesting. It had the Squirrel Hill Theater on Forward Avenue, and then on Murray, it had the Manor Theater.
Uh-huh.
And the Guild.
Okay.
And my theater and the Guild played almost exclusively foreign movies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, the kinds for intellectuals, some of them with subtitles. And
yeah.
Most of ours came from England or France or Italy. We seated about 800 people, and the Guild was smaller.
It seated
about 300.
I never attended any of those theaters. I have enjoyed foreign films, international films, but we would always go to the Pittsburgh Playhouse to see them. Or the Regent,
which, of course,
Theater.
Incidentally, was originally a synagogue.
That's true, yes. It was actually a couple of buildings that were next to each other. They joined together. But, you know, that's moved now. The Pittsburgh Playhouse has moved to downtown there.
Right.
They've abandoned that other facility. Gosh, I'll have to check. The King's Court is no longer there, but for some reason I thought that was in the lower Squirrel Hill area. I could be wrong.
I think it was in Oakland, but I'm not sure.
Well, anyway, you've kind of got my memory going. I have to look that up now. None of those theaters, to the best of my knowledge, are still in existence, right?
The Squirrel Hill closed maybe 10 years ago. The Manor is still in operation.
Mm-hmm.
It played standard Hollywood movies,
mm-hmm.
and I think it still does. It used to have one auditorium, and I believe it has now two or three, but that's the only one left.
Well, thanks for the call, my friend. Maybe some of our listeners will have an answer to your questions that you posed.
Thanks for allowing me to call in.
Sure. Good to talk with you. Thanks very much.
Take care.
283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. Jewish religion is obviously rich in tradition, dating back millennia. Millennia, that's for sure. And they have a holiday coming up before too much longer. Hanukkah is very early this year. December 2nd, I believe, is the date for Hanukkah. By the way, thank you, Patrick Parker, who's on the other side of the glass here, helping to produce the program today, and he has the dates for the items that we were talking about with one of our earlier callers. The Evening with Old Blue Eyes, Frank Sinatra music, with Vince Tavolario is December 13th. December 13th. And the date for Men Who Cook has been solidified. It's February 23rd. That's a ways off yet. February 23rd for Men Who Cook. It's a fun night. We've had a lot of fun with that. So, caller, you can mark those on your calendar there if you have a calendar already for 2019. I do not. Reminds me, I have to order a couple of those. And, Butler County Historical Society calendar is done. I'll have to get Pat Collins here on the program to talk about it. That makes a wonderful stocking stuffer for folks. especially if you have friends or relatives who have moved out of the area and they want to, you know, kind of keep in touch with Butler. I'm not sure what it is this year. What it's a bicentennial, sesquicentennial, some kind of an anniversary of Butler. So we'll get Pat on here very shortly, and we'll do that quickly because a lot of folks like to order those calendars for Christmas stocking stuffers. They've been available for a $10 donation. I would assume that's the same this year, but we'll find out. I'll let you know when Pat can come on with us. Meanwhile, with holiday season just around the corner, what about favorite recipes from your mom's or your grandmother's cookbook? Now, my mom had a recipe box. As far as I know, she didn't have too many cookbooks. But she had a box that contained recipes. It was like index cards, okay? You know what I'm talking about. And that's where her recipes were. And this would be about the time of the year when the cookie baking process would get underway. My mom loved to bake cookies. And she was a good cookie maker. Yeah. She made lemon drop cookies with little tiny pieces of lemon peel in them. And orange cookies. Tiny pieces of orange peel in them. Mouth watering. Chocolate drop. Perhaps my favorite. With the chocolate icing. And then she had a recipe for, and I think these cookies have different names. My mom always called them thumbprint cookies. They had like ground up walnuts and the cookie dough, and then as you put them on the cookie sheet, you would press your thumb down in the middle, okay? That's where the name thumbprint came from. And then after they baked, you'd fill that little depression, that hole, with the frosting. And my mom would always use red and green, with food coloring, of course, red and green frosting. Oh, those were delicious cookies. And they were little, too. So, you felt like you could eat a couple of them, or maybe three or four, without blowing your diet. But that's what you do at holiday time anyway, right? Holiday cookies. I miss those cookies. Yeah, delicious. Any favorites from your household at holiday time? Yeah. Mom used to make them early, and then she would put them in various tins. You know, she had cookie tins, and she would keep them in, keep them fresh. And as long as they were in those airtight tins, you know, they'd keep for several weeks. Good. Now I'm hungry. Now I need a cup of coffee on this rainy, chilly day, dreary day. I need a cup of coffee and a couple of cookies. Sounds pretty good. Open talk at 283-2525, our number, 283-2525. Once again, I enjoyed over the Veterans Day holiday weekend, Turner Classic Movies. They've done this for several years that I've been watching them. Turner Classic Movies, I think, has been around for about 20, 25 years now. But they run a marathon weekend of war movies. Now, I don't watch them all. And some of them are, you know, not so good. But a couple of my favorites were on, and I watched them both over the weekend. Guns of Navarone. I've probably seen that movie 20 times. And I've read the book probably 10 times. I love that film. Gregory Peck and Anthony Quinn were just unbelievable. Unbelievable. That was fun. It was fun to watch that again over the weekend, Veterans Day. Well, let's get back to the people here. It's Open Talk at 283-2525. Hi, caller. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Oh, boy, you're bringing back memories of recipe box. My oldest brother got it, and he's in California. Of course, he passed away, and his wife has it now, and how am I supposed to get my mother's recipes back off of her? But anyway, I have a lot of her recipes. My favorite cookies are sugar cookies. cut out cookies.
Yeah, and at holiday time, you usually had snowmen and Santa Claus and that kind of stuff. Stars, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I still do that. I do six different kinds of cookies every year, and I give them away for gifts. And a few years ago, I stopped giving them to my stepdaughter because she's 19 years old. You know, she's on her own now. And earlier this year, you know, her mother passed away, and we were talking about holidays and stuff like that, and she said, am I going to get some of your cookies? And she never said, you know, coming over to our house every other weekend that, you know, your cookies are really good. But at 19 years old, she realizes that, and she remembers that. So that's a memory I left in her head, and I like that because, you know, she doesn't want to do it. She said, that's too much work. Yeah, 19 years old, you don't want to play with them, so.
Well,
but I love making cookies.
It is in many families. It's something that's dying out because you know, for generations the recipes were passed down from grandma to mom to daughter, and that's just the way it was. And not all, but in some families that tradition is dying out. You know,
my daughter doesn't cook at all. She's never made cookies, and she's 40 years old. And that is so hard for me to believe because I started making them when I was 19, 20 years old, whenever I first got married. So, I don't know what to say about it, but someday they'll regret. I know a lot of people don't know how to cook at all. They don't even know how to boil water, and I think that's terrible because someday you're going to be on your own, and I don't know who's cooking for you. But that's why we guess we have restaurants. They eat out every day. So, all right. Thanks for the memories. And you have a good day.
And you. Thank you. And my memory was jogged when I saw that article about the recipe falling out from Jennifer O'Connell's grandmother's cookbook. She didn't say how she happened to come by her grandmother's cookbook. But when the recipe fell out, then the memories started to come. Open talk at 283-2525, 283-2525. Great memories of this time of year when, obviously, when you were very young, as you headed into the holiday season. This would be about the time of the year when I was a little kid that the Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Ward Christmas catalogs would arrive. Anybody remember those? Now, these are not the regular catalogs. You know, we at our house, we always had a big Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Ward catalog. But both of those companies put out a holiday catalog that would arrive usually in early November. And it was you know, just holiday stuff. Of course, my brother and I instantly went to the toy section, which, as I recall, was humongous. Of course, you know, when you're 6, 7, 8 years old, it was humongous. And you'd look and you'd develop a wish list and you'd talk about it, you know, talk about it with your friends. By the time you got to early December, the toy pages of the Montgomery Ward and Roebuck catalogs would be all dog-eared and about ready to fall out. But that was the wish list for Christmas time. And then as you got a little older, you had different memories. Not necessarily better ones, but different ones. You know, as the family started to gather, we always had family that would come in at Thanksgiving time. And in some cases, our great aunt would stay until Christmas. She would come at Thanksgiving time and stay until Christmas. And that would vary from year to year. This year, it must be, I don't know, Thanksgiving seems rather early. Thanksgiving's next week. And after Thanksgiving, there's still more than a week left in November, which is kind of unusual. But then November 1st was a Thursday this year, so that's probably why it comes so early. But it means there's going to be almost an extra week between Thanksgiving and Christmas this year, just the way the calendar falls. Well, thank goodness we have these wonderful memories, huh? Of the holiday season, the approaching holiday season. Because otherwise, it'd be pretty hard to deal with this dreary weather, these dreary conditions. And can you imagine if you lived further north? You know, you don't have to go too much further north, up into Ontario, even Maine, where the daylight hours are even shorter than they are here. Because the further north you go, you're headed toward the Arctic Circle, where they go several weeks without any sunshine at all. I don't know whether I'd be able to deal with that. And I've read some wire stories about people that live in Scandinavian countries, Norway, Sweden, Finland, even Denmark. And they really have short daylight hours in the wintertime. And they also, unsurprisingly, I guess, have a lot of problems with alcoholism in those countries. Some people think, I guess, it's dark and cold, we might as well drink. I don't know. They've also, some of those countries, Sweden, I think I was reading about, because of that, they have very, very strict laws on driving while intoxicated. Very strict. It's not a question of, you get pulled over and you get a ticket and then later you have a hearing and so on and so forth. Police officers can take your license on the spot in some of those countries where they have very, very strict rules on driving under the influence. On the spot. You don't wait for a summons to come in the mail or a hearing before a magistrate or any of that stuff. You lose your license right there. Maybe for the best, especially around holiday time. 283-2525 is our number. Open talk. I do want to remind you that we have a book talk coming up at the end of the month. Still a little less than 2 weeks away. And I have a copy of the book we're going to be discussing. I haven't started to read it yet. It's called Lincoln's Last Trial, the murder case that propelled Abraham Lincoln to the presidency. And I didn't know anything about this, quite frankly, before I got a copy of this book. I knew that Lincoln, of course, had run for public office. In fact, had run and been defeated in the famous Lincoln-Douglas debate. And I knew that Abraham Lincoln practiced law, but I did not know that he defended a man accused of murder, the last case before his presidency. So we'll talk about that with Cheryl Ferrero from the Mars Area Public Library. They selected this book. I'm happy that they did. It sounds pretty interesting. I'm going to start reading it over the weekend. Lincoln's Last Trial, in case you're interested in taking a look at it before we discuss it on the 26th. Is that the right day? November 26th. Well, coming up later on the program today, we're going to be chatting in a couple of minutes here with Carol Havanchik about care packages for veterans. It's a program that's not brand new. It's been ongoing in area school. So we'll talk about that with Carol. I guess they're going to be doing it again this year. Maybe they've already started. I'm not sure. Also talking about how important it is to make sure that our children realize the importance of being kind and being compassionate. Our guest to talk about that will be Dr. Dale Atkins and Amanda Salzhauer. Also, in this week of Veterans Day, we observed Veterans Day yesterday, and we'll be talking about an incident in World War II with Robert Fowler, historian who's written about it. And we're going to talk about germs also later on the program today. Chat for a few minutes with Mark Olshaker about our war against germs. Medical professionals say we're heading into the time of the year when it is easiest to get sick. Because, well, it's the weather for one thing, and it's not the fact that you go out without a coat on. It's the fact that we spend so much more time indoors, shut up indoors, and, opportunity for germs to spread from person to person very, very easily. So we'll talk about that for a few minutes later today with Mark Olshaker. Okay, take a break, and we'll continue with the Tuesday edition, the dreary Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR in just a moment. One of our sponsors on the program today is Butler Motor Tours. You got a couple of trips coming up in early December that you might be interested in. One is down to West Virginia to Ogle Bay and their Festival of Lights down there. And this is it's a nice trip. It's a one-evening affair, but you enjoy a dinner and Ogle Bay Festival of Lights, and then you can climb on the coach and rest easy on the way back from West Virginia. You won't have to worry about driving in the dark or when you're tired or whatever. They also are taking a trip in early December down to Ligonier, a beautiful town in the Laurel Mountains, for their festival down there, country Christmas traditions, and they've got lots of stuff going down there in Ligonier, too. Some beautiful shops down there. And, of course, you can take a look on their website, butlerbus.com, about the upcoming trips in early part of 2019 down to Florida. Butler Motor Tours. Been around for more than 75 years now, taking folks from our area to places near and far for a day or two or a week or two. Check out their offerings online at butlerbus.com. Butler Motor Tours, South Monroe Street in Butler, online at butlerbus.com. Butlerbus.com. We'll be right back.
Sunnyview Nursing and Rehabilitation Center has a rich history in Butler. Now they are making continuous improvements and technological advancements to better serve the community. Sunnyview specializes in short-term rehabilitation and skilled nursing. Schedule a tour to see their beautiful facility. Call 332-6872 or visit sunnyviewcenter.com. Sunnyview Nursing and Rehabilitation Center, close to your home and close to your heart.
If you're curious, the news informs you, but it also piques your curiosity. Enter The Context, a free weekday morning newsletter from PA Post. PA Post is the statewide nonprofit and nonpartisan news organization reporting on public policy issues in the state. The Context ties together compelling stories from across Pennsylvania with insight and perspective and points your curiosity in a meaningful direction. Start your subscription today at papost.org.
Your daughter looks up to you. She loves that you love soccer. You're her MVP. Together, you can take on underage drinking. From ages 8 through 11, kids are most open to parents' messages about alcohol. So learn the facts and defend her against the harms of alcohol. Take your best shot at underage drinking, one-on-one. Talk with your kids about alcohol. Learn more at knowwhennohow.org. A message from the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board.
Do you have an Amazon Echo, Tap, or Dot in your home? If you do, you can load the new Butler Radio News skill and get the latest local news, sports, and weather from Alexa anytime you want. The Butler Radio News skill is the area's only skill to offer local news, sports, and weather. To get the skill, open your Alexa app, search for Butler Radio News, and enable the skill. It's that simple. Alexa, what's in the news?
From the Butler Radio Network, here is the latest news.
The Butler Radio Network is proud to be a leader in providing up-to-date local content to you on the devices you use, on your radio, your computer or tablet, your smartphone, and now on your Amazon Alexa device.
It's the holiday season, and you're buying gifts for everyone, but not everyone lives around here anymore. So you've got to ship those gifts, and you want a local, reliable shipping company that you can trust to get that package to your loved ones. We suggest Going Postal in Butler. Going Postal, just off Newcastle Road. They'll find a way to ship just about anything. Simple, too. Just take the gift up. They pack it. They ship it. And if you want to get stocking stuffers like lottery tickets or Christmas cards, they've got those, too. They're just off Newcastle Road, right in between Villa Grande and King's Restaurant. Going Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping store.
Did you read comic books when you were a kid? Maybe you still do. I don't know. One of the famed comic book writers of all time has died. He lived a good long life, that's for sure. His name is Stan Lee. Word of his death came yesterday afternoon. He was 95.
died out in Los Angeles, who was Stan Lee. Well, he was the creator of Spider-Man. He was the creator of The Hulk. The Hulk, of course, went on to become a TV show and a couple of films. Right? And that Lou Ferrigno, the Green Man, yeah. Spider-Man, of course, I don't know how many Spider-Man movies have been made. And he also created the Fantastic Four. I'm not familiar with those. I didn't read any Marvel comics. Stan Lee started out as a writer of comic books, and he ended up being the publisher of Marvel. And a lot of folks consider him the founder of superheroes. I don't know. I saw that in his obituary, and I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. That was Marvel Comics. The big rival for Marvel Comics is DC Comics. And DC Comics, that's Superman. And the rest of that gang, you know, Superman, Supergirl, Superboy, and some others. And we had Superman before we had Spider-Man. So, I don't know. Not to take away from Stan Lee. He was certainly a great writer of comic books. I do remember reading a Superman comic book or two when I was a kid. But not too many. Not too many. And I, to be honest with you, I didn't realize the comic book business was still such a big business. I mean, where do you buy them? They got newsstands or bookstores or somewhere? Where do you buy comic books? I don't know. Mad Magazine is still being published. I've seen that in the magazine racks and bookstores, but I guess comic books are still pretty big. Anyway, rest in peace, Stan Lee, creator of Spider-Man and The Hulk. Well, we were scheduled to chat with Carol Havancik, but we've been unable to make a connection with her, so maybe her schedule is not permitting her to chat with us here today. She's a teacher, so I think what we're going to do is take a quick break here, and then we'll check in with Dr. Dale Atkins and Amanda Salzhauer, and we'll be talking about how to make sure that our children realize how important it is to be kind and compassionate. So a quick break, and then we'll talk with them here on the It's Your Turn program on a Tuesday. We'll be right back.
The leader in medical marijuana and the first step to your medical marijuana card is Compassionate Certification Centers. Don't know where to start? Visit cccregister.com. Get qualified quickly for a low fee and with no drug screening or referral needed. Tired of taking pills? Visit cccregister.com. Visit cccregister.com or call 888-316-9085 today. Walk-in hours available. Compassionate Certification Centers, the first step to your medical marijuana card.
Coming up on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guests are two. They join us by telephone, Dr. Dale Atkins and Amanda Salzhauer. They are the co-authors of a book entitled The Kindness Advantage. Dr. Atkins, let me go to you first. The Kindness Advantage, that's an interesting title. What do you mean by that?
Well, what we mean by that is that being kind can make us feel good and help us feel connected to other people and to our environment, and it gives our life meaning. And so we wanted to call the book The Kindness Advantage because we would like all of our children to have that in their lives. And if we start really early cultivating what's already in them and nurturing what's already in them, because we're all hardwired for kindness, we thought that that would be one way to help make our world a better place.
Yes, the subtitle of your book, The Kindness Advantage, is Cultivating Compassionate and Connected Children. Amanda Salzhauer, I dare say that in our day and age today, that might be more difficult than it has been in any time in recent history with all of the violence that's going on in the world, the bullying and so on. A lot of parents don't really know where to start talking about these things with their kids, right?
Absolutely, Dave. And we are living in challenging times. That said, you know, there's been a lot of research on kindness and the links between kindness and happiness, and we know that being kind can have a positive impact. It helps us feel good. It helps, you know, those around us feel good. There was a study that was done with kids between 9 and 11 who regularly engaged in acts of kindness. And what these researchers found is that these youngsters were typically had improved academic performance, improved self-esteem, and were less likely to bully others as teenagers. So although it may not be so obvious where the connection is, it's there. So our goal is to help give parents and grandparents the tools they need to nurture these, as Dale said, sort of qualities that we are, you know, hardwired for.
Let me go back to Dr. Atkins here. Talk a little bit about the structure of your book, Doctor. You actually have texts in here that are to be read and discussed with kids, right?
Yes, we have. We talk about 10 fundamentals of kindness, and each one is given some pages. And we talk. We have a section of for you to read with your child, for you to read alone, and for you to, you know, activities that you can do with your child. We have real-life stories that are examples of kids from all over the world who have done some amazing, amazing things with their talents, with their passions. And these are kids who are very, very young. And then we have resources. We have troubleshooting, you know, what to do when you're really have a tough situation. We have conversation starters, things to talk about that may be difficult to talk about. We have ideas for role-playing. So it's not really a workbook, but it's a guide, and we have a lot of interaction. We have journal pages for parents to write their thoughts about, you know, maybe some opportunities for volunteering that they'd like to investigate with their kids, and just thoughts that they're having about the process. So it's interactive. You can read it all the way through and then talk about it with your kid, or you can read it with your kid. So we really wanted it to be a very accessible guide for parents and grandparents. And so far we've been really happy with the response because it seems to be helpful. It's relatable. And what we like is that there are examples that kids can see themselves in those examples and say, gee, I'd like to do something like that.
And Amanda, these are real life examples. We're not talking about abstract stuff here. I've been glancing through a review copy of your book, and for example, what to do if your child is staring at someone in public, or what to do when your child says, "Why does Lisa have two daddies?" These are questions that come up these days, and parents and grandparents and others, Amanda, they need to know how to deal with these whenever the time occurs, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, and we really tried to make the book as accessible and practical as possible. And, you know, I have 3 teenage daughters. Dale has 2 adult sons and 6 grandchildren. So we've both been in, you know, a lot of these situations and had those, oh, my goodness, what do I say to this one kind of moments. And what we want parents to learn and think about is, first of all, if your child comes to you with a question that you don't know how to answer in the moment, that is okay. It's okay to say, you know, that's a great question, sweetie, and I want to talk to you more about that, but let's do it tonight once we're home when we can sit and talk in a, you know, uninterrupted or that kind of thing. And if you need to, go do a little research first. Think about, think about how you want to answer the question. And one of the goals for us is to help parents keep the lines of communication with their child open, because that is such an important thing, especially in this day and age when, you know, there's so much going on as our kids get older that might be happening online that we're not, you know, that we're not aware of. We want our kids to know that they can come to us with anything, and try to answer in a way that's non-judgmental, and have those conversations that are so important for our kids, both to get information from us, but also an opportunity for us to reinforce whatever our particular family's values may be. So there are always questions that are going to come up, and we want to give parents, you know, the skills to feel as comfortable answering those questions as possible.
I'll go back to Dr. Atkins for this question, and I mentioned early in our conversation, especially in today's society, we need to be concerned about this. A child comes home from school and is visibly shaken. They've had their first lockdown exercise in school. My goodness, we didn't even think about this, Doctor, whenever we were in school.
Of course not. We never did. And to your point particularly, your city has had this most recently.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, to be able to have a kid get a feeling of being okay and safe in an environment that clearly isn't is really a challenge. And I think that the first thing is for parents to try and collect themselves. And, you know, if you're a nervous wreck trying to calm your child is going to respond to what they feel from you rather than what you say. And, of course, you need to be honest and you need to be forthright because kids see right through us and they read our emotions. But I think that you can also go to the facts and say, this is what is being done so that we can be safe. And, you know, we listen to what the teachers are saying, what we need to do, and the police are coming, or whoever it is, and we're doing this to practice so that in case there is a problem, we will be safe. And, you know, you will be with your teachers, and you focus on the positive. Now, the other side of that is when the tragedy happens, how do you deal with that? And then, you know, depending on the developmental age of your child, you talk about why this might have happened and why, you know, certain people do the things that they do based on hatred or prejudice or whatever it is that they're doing and a lack of understanding. And you try to also help your child understand that although there are people who are acting in this way, there are so many other people who are coming with kindness and comforting. And again, I turn to your city, which showed the world what it's like to be able to be supportive and to be there and the connection that is important, because what we know from the research also and just from our experience is that when people are in peril and when people are frightened, to be able to have the support of others, to know that they're not alone and that other people stand up and are with them and are witness and are advocates and are allies, that's what is important. And we want to teach our children to be those people. We want them to be connected and to be compassionate, and no matter what happens, to be able to stand up for what is right.
We're
hardwired to be kind.
We're just scratching the surface here, folks, in the limited time we have available. There are many, many other tips and advice in this book, talking to your kids about what they see in movies and TV, even questions that every parent gets, where do babies come from? The title of the book.
We tried to cover a lot.
Yes. The title of the book is The Kindness Advantage, Cultivating Compassionate and Connected Children by Dale Atkins and Amanda Salzhauer. They've been our guests here. Thank you very much, folks. Thanks for joining us today. We are going to be talking about a World War II story on the next segment of the program here today. Veterans Week, Veterans Day observed yesterday. And we had a nice parade, by the way, downtown Butler. It was mighty chilly early yesterday morning, but that didn't dampen the spirits of those who attended the Veterans Day parade downtown. We're going to be talking about the story of the USS Duncan, a U.S. ship that was sunk during World War II. Perhaps not a widely known story. We will get the background on it from historian Robert Fowler coming up in just a moment or so. I also want to mention we talked about John Mahler over the past couple of days. John, a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force, was the pilot of a B-17, a Flying Fortress bomber during the Second World War. He celebrated his 100th birthday yesterday. Now, actually, a lot of folks celebrated a couple of days early because they had a big party for him on Friday afternoon in the auditorium at the A.B. Abraham VA Healthcare Center here in Butler. A big party, like 100, 150 people there, and rightly so for a man's 100th birthday. So we talked about that. I got a chance to stop in and say hi to John. I hadn't seen him since, back around Labor Day. That's when I had him on the program here, and we had a wonderful chat. And I've had so many people ask about it. It was the day after Labor Day, and I guess some folks still weren't back into regular mode. I don't know, but they didn't hear the interview. We are going to repeat it tomorrow. I had people, in fact, when I stopped in at John's birthday party on Friday, ask me about the interview and is there any chance of, you know, replaying it? And I said, yes, we'll do it. So we're going to do that tomorrow as we kick off the program tomorrow. If you didn't get a chance to hear it, it's a wonderful story. John Mahler not only talks a little bit, very modestly, by the way, about his time piloting a B-17, most of his missions were in the North Africa and Italy, as I recall. But John is also believed to be the oldest living former employee of the Pullman Standard plant here in Butler. So we'll talk about that too. Jim Diamond, who's compiling historical records about the Pullman plant, former engineer at Pullman, was also here with us with John whenever they came in early September. So, yes, in answer to a lot of people's requests that we take another listen to that program, we will do it tomorrow, starting at 12:30. Okay, quick break here, and then, as promised, we learn about the USS Duncan, the sinking of the USS Duncan. It's coming up here on It's Your Turn on WISR on a dreary Tuesday, right after this.
Helping one another is what Central Electric Cooperative's Family Fund is all about. This program helps members pay their electric bill when times are tough. The funding comes from members who round up their electric bills to the nearest whole dollar. Members can also make a one-time or monthly donation. Funds are distributed by local social service agencies to qualified members. 357 families were assisted in paying their electric bill in 2017. If you are a Central Electric member, why not help those less fortunate by donating to the Family Fund today? To learn more about energy assistance, new products, and saving money on your energy bill, visit our website at www.central.coop. This is Ken Molesky with Central Electric Cooperative. Our tradition is to service. Our responsibility is to safety. Central Electric Cooperative is an equal opportunity provider and employer.
We have a World War II story, World War II history story to talk about today, folks. And I dare say many of you will probably not be familiar with the story of the USS Duncan. Our guest is Robert Fowler. He's written a book entitled The Gun Club, the USS Duncan at Cape Esperance. Robert Fowler, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us here today.
Yeah, thanks, Dave.
Am I pronouncing it correctly? Cape Esperance?
Esperance did very well.
That's right. And where exactly, I know it's in the South Pacific, where exactly is Cape Esperance?
It's the northwesternmost point of the island of Guadalcanal.
Ah, okay.
So it's right between, Savo Island is 6 miles off Cape Esperance.
And this Battle of Cape Esperance took place in the fall of 1942. I have the correct year?
That's right.
So what exactly happened there, Robert Fowler?
Well, it was the Marines had been fighting on Guadalcanal for a month, and the Navy finally decided that they needed to stop the Japanese resupplying the island every night. Or this battle was going to go on forever. And so they put together a cruiser-destroyer task force and sent them out to intercept the Japanese fleet. And that's what happened. They ran into the Japanese fleet.
So the Japanese were coming to supply reinforcements at
the
Guadalcanal?
The Japanese were coming down to reinforce, to reinforce with troops and supplies and medical stuff.
Well, let's just set the timeline for our listeners. Pearl Harbor, of course, was December of 1941. This is early October of 1942, so it's a little bit less than a year later. But up until
just as a little background, the Navy's plan always, you know, all through the 30s for the next war, was to fight it with battleships. It was all built around battleships.
Mm-hmm.
And in Pearl Harbor, you know, a lot of the battleships were wiped out, and they suddenly had to come up with a new way to fight a war. And the final decision was with aircraft carriers and these cruiser destroyer groups. And so this was, this battle I'm writing about is really the first time they ever tried to use a cruiser destroyer group as a separate unit.
Mm-hmm. And this, as I understand it, well, I mean, obviously the United States had, there were some defensive actions after Pearl Harbor. We had to try to rebuild our fleet in addition to changing strategy. And this was, I guess, the first really planned naval attack, the first planned naval offensive by the U.S.
You know, there's so many things about that war you forget. Is, you know, nobody in the Navy had ever been in a battle. You know, the last battle was 40 years earlier, so, you know, there was absolutely nobody in the Navy who'd ever been in a battle. So everything was new. I mean, they were improvising as they went. And the really impressive thing about the Navy is, you know, they made a lot of mistakes, but they learned quickly. And this was a really prime case of that. There was all kinds of things came out of this battle, you know, and within days they were implementing it on the scene.
Let's talk a little bit about the battle. Very tragically for you and your family, your father died in this battle, did he not?
My father died in the battle. Just to tell you the story of the battle roughly, the two fleets met off Guadalcanal, off Savo Island, actually. And the orders were, when the destroyers who were in the vanguard of the American fleet saw the Japanese on radar, they were supposed to charge at them. My father's ship did that, assuming that the other ships behind him would do the same thing, but none of the others did. And so my father's ship wound up between the two fleets and was taken under fire by both sides. So it was kind of a mess as a battle. I mean, the real problem was radar was so new in the Navy that nobody really had any experience with it, and except for radar men and fire control men. And the Admiral didn't trust it at all. He didn't trust any electronics. He had them actually turn off the radar on two of the ships because he thought the older radar would give them away to the Japanese. So when the battle actually broke out, the Admiral had no idea who everybody was firing at. He didn't even realize the Japanese were there.
The USS...
So it was kind of a mess that way, but just to finish what I was saying about how quickly they realized things, the Navy suddenly realized that what they needed on all their fighting ships were captains who were willing to fight. A lot of these, you know, peace had gone on for so long that the guys who rose in the fleet were, you know, kind of armchair admirals, and, you know, they were looking for guys who would really fight. And what the Gun Club, the reason the book's called The Gun Club is the Gun Club was kind of a semi-secret society in the Navy of guys who'd gone to Annapolis, played football at Annapolis, so they were aggressive guys to begin with, and then they'd specialized in gunnery during the 1930s. And during the 30s, gunnery evolved so fast that nobody understood it except for the gunnery guys, and so these guys tended to get promoted much faster all through the 30s than anybody else. And after the Battle of Cape Esperance, the Navy suddenly realized they'd better get some fighting captains under these ships. And so there was a huge surge of transfers, and, you know, a lot of guys were sent back to Washington quickly, and other guys were sent out to the Pacific quickly.
So we're talking about gunnery at sea, which is
gunnery at sea. It's an incredibly complicated thing to hit a ship with a gun. I mean, they're both moving at high speeds, and, you know, it's almost an impossible thing to do. And only these guys knew how to do it, and, you know, even they failed most of the time. But
the USS Duncan was a destroyer. Am I correct on that?
It was a destroyer. Yes, it was a destroyer. The guys who the book takes place in the course of 1 year. It follows this ship from the time it's launched. These guys joined the ship in the second week of February. And I mean, second week of January in 1942, so really right after Pearl Harbor. They were already in the Navy when Pearl Harbor happened. So they weren't in for, you know, to fight a war. They were in, most of the average age on this ship was like 22 years old, and most of them had never had a job. They were so happy in 1940 when the Navy opened enlistments, and they all rushed in because it was the first job they'd been able to get in their entire life, and they were looking for, you know, a bed and three meals a day. I mean, as soon as Pearl Harbor happened, everybody went in, and, you know, it was a whole, it was a patriotic thing. But these guys were there because, you know, they were there for the, most of them were there for the work. My father was there because he was an, you know, Anglophile, and he was there to fight for poor little England. And then he was sent to the Pacific, but that was just one of...
Help us a little bit on, because I'm not particularly knowledgeable on the relative size of... American ships at that time. And when I first heard that the strategy was for the destroyers to charge the Japanese fleet,
they were supposed to charge at the Japanese fleet, fire torpedoes at the biggest ship, and then light the ships with searchlights so that the cruisers with the bigger guns could take them under fire.
Ah, okay. No, I'm sensing the strategy. I just thought
that was the basic strategy. Yeah.
Almost seemed like a futile mission to send.
The thing is, it was a pitch black night. I mean, there was no moon, no stars. I mean, it was really they couldn't see their hand in front of their faces really, and they couldn't even see the other American ships. And then when they start firing flares to try to light the battlefield, you know, the flares are moving and the ships are moving and the shadows are everywhere, and you know, nobody, after the battle was over, nobody really, even the people on deck who could see, you know, most people on these ships are below deck anyway, so they don't see anything. But the guys who were on deck, you know, everybody had a different story. They didn't know what they were looking at. Hmm.
And so then when they turned on the searchlights, it illuminated the USS Duncan. And
Well, that's the thing. The Duncan was between the two fleets, and the American ships thought the Duncan was a Japanese ship, and especially after it was hit and its one of its smokestacks fell down, and as soon as that happened, it looked exactly like a Japanese destroyer.
Wow.
And so then everybody was firing at it.
Did the obviously there was tremendous loss of life, including tragically your father. Did the Duncan survive, or was it sunk?
No, it was actually sunk. They went out and sank it. They thought it was sinking for few hours, and it never sank, and so they finally sank it. There were 240 people on board, and 40 something died, mostly in the battle. A few in the water from sharks and just swimming off in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm. Were there any records saved from the ship, Robert?
The records? You mean as far as the ship's log?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The log went down. The log, you know, well, the reason I was able to write this book in the first place is because the log exists, because the logs are turned in at the end of every month. So the log up to 12 days before the battle survived. Just the last 12 days are missing. But I was able to reconstruct those from the logs of other ships that were there. So, that's how that was done.
We're talking, listeners, with Robert Fowler, the author of a new book entitled The Gun Club, the USS Duncan at Cape Esperance. A quick break. We'll be back to talk for a few more minutes with our guest here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
For more than 130 years, the name Concordia has meant quality care. Today, Concordia Visiting Nurses has provided high-quality, skilled nursing and a variety of therapy services to people in and around our community. Concordia Visiting Nurses is here to foster your recovery right in your own home. If you're in need of home health care, choose Concordia Visiting Nurses. Call toll-free at 1-877-352-6200.
As the Christmas season approaches, WISR looks forward to bringing the sounds of the season to our listeners and being Butler's official Christmas music station. This year, we're expanding our Christmas programming to include concerts by local churches, schools, and community choirs. At this time, we're inviting any community organization to submit a recording of their holiday concert to be included in our Christmas choir broadcasts. You can record a rehearsal or a live performance and submit it to us in MP3 format via email to info@bcrnetwork.com. We'll choose 6 performances from all those submitted to be featured in our Christmas choir broadcasts on December 15th and 22nd. Deadline to submit your recording is December 11th. WISR, your hometown station, is proud to support and broadcast local Christmas concerts this holiday season.
Welcome back. We're chatting with the author Robert Fowler about his book, The Gun Club, the USS Duncan at Cape Esperance. How did you, with your father, of course, be killed in this battle, how did you learn about it, Robert? How did you start?
Well, growing up, it was always a great mystery what had happened. My mother blamed the captain for, you know, being a hero and getting them all killed. And my grandfather spent a lot of time after the war trying to collect papers to try to figure it out. And he collected a lot of papers. When he died, he left me this suitcase full of stuff he'd collected, but it was all incomprehensible to me and to him, I think. But then 50 years after the battle, my mother got a note from the Duncan crew. They were going to have their first reunion. This is what happened with these guys. You know, they never talked about the war. When we went down to Fort Lauderdale, my mother and I, and we sat in this motel and listened to these guys, watched these guys drinking and reminiscing, and as they got drunker and drunker. And a lot of them brought wives, and the wives were all crying because they'd never heard their husbands even mention the war in, you know, in 50 years of marriage. And that whole generation, they really never talked about the war until their grandchildren started asking questions. And that was pretty much 50 years later. So all these ships, like 50 years later, started having reunions. Anyway, the Duncan had a reunion, and I went hoping, you know, assuming that I was, you know, suddenly going to find out what had happened. And the big realization there was that I realized that none of them knew what had happened. It was a complete mystery to all of them. But all of them had a little piece of the puzzle. You know, and these ships are so big, you know, the front part of the ship fought one war, and the back part of the ship was fighting another ship. They were fighting two different ships, the front and the back. You know, it was a complicated puzzle to put together. And also, the night battles at sea are sort of like reconstructing battles in the desert where there's no landmarks. You know, it's you have no idea where. You know, you can't say, well, you're 600 feet from a mountain there.
Yeah.
You know, there's, so it's all in relation to other ships that are moving, it's, you know, at high speeds. So it's quite a complicated proposition. And they had trouble reconstructing it themselves after the battle. The officers were supposed to put it all together, and they were completely confused, too.
When you went to this first reunion of survivors, did they accept you once they knew that your father had died on the Duncan?
Oh, yeah. I was adopted by them, basically.
Oh, really?
It went on for years. I went to reunions for, like, 10 years. And each reunion, different guys showed up. And they were wonderful. I spent weekends at their houses. And, I became great friends with a lot of them.
Yeah, we have very few World
War II
veterans
still
alive.
And they were very, you know, they wanted to know themselves what had happened. You know, they were very supportive of the whole project. And they did all they could to... You know, every time they figured some little thing out, they'd call me and all excited. So it was kind of a group project, and it's told in basically in their words. It's all told in. And the book takes place, I told you, from when they reported the ship in January of 42 to when the survivors made it home for Christmas that year, and the story of the Duncan is in between.
Was your father one of the original crew members?
He was, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Plank owner, they call him.
What's that responsibility entail?
Nothing. You kind of lord it over the guys who came a little later.
Oh, okay.
That's about it.
Did your father have specific responsibilities on the ship?
Well, yes, he was the morale officer, but morale was so... Morale was so low, I don't think the morale officer was able to do much. They spent a lot of time in the Caribbean before they got to the Pacific, and it was incredibly hot and very rough, and everybody was sick and, you know, unable to eat. They couldn't eat, you know, they couldn't, the mess couldn't even feed them. It was so rough, and, you know, they were eating bread, and that's pretty much it.
What about this captain that your mother blamed?
Well, the tyrant actually was the executive officer. The captain actually was a fascinating guy. He was a hero. He was a big football hero at Annapolis, and his name was Whitey Taylor, and he was a major football star, and he became, as a result of this battle, you know, he was the guy. If this battle had happened 2 weeks earlier, he probably would have been cashiered for losing his ship, because all the captains who lost their ships during that period were sent back to Washington in disgrace. But Halsey had just come into power in South Pacific, and he was looking for guys who would actually fight, and he realized this was a guy. These guys were kind of minor gun club guys, and so they wound up being promoted very quickly. And he wound up a vice admiral, and during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he was the guy who commanded the naval fleet off that cordoned off Cuba.
Wow. Huh.
So he had a very successful naval career.
Hmm. Well, the irony
But the executive officer was a real tyrant. He was like this perfect naval officer. He was better at everything than everybody else, and, you know, and let them know it. And they were always terrified. Everybody was terrified of him. But, you know, Duncan always got top honors and everything, so I think you need to be a tyrant when you're the executive officer, because you're really running the ship.
We've seen some of that in movies. I have.
Yes, exactly. You know, the funny thing is, when I first went to that first meeting in Fort Lauderdale, a lot of guys came up to me and said, you know, when I read the Kane Mutiny, I thought it was about the Duncan. And actually, the guy who wrote the Kane Mutiny, I forget his name for the moment, he served on a destroyer that actually was with Duncan for a while, so I thought maybe, you know, the officer would go to the officers' clubs at night on shore and trade stories. I always suspected that, you know, some of the stories were about the Duncan, because there was a lot of things of missing strawberries. Not missing strawberries, but missing things like that.
That's exactly the movie I was thinking of when I said
that. Yeah.
Good stuff. Well, the great irony here is that the U.S. actually won this battle.
They won the battle. They sank a cruiser and a destroyer and lost one destroyer. So, by that count, they won. But it was such a messy battle that nobody was very proud of it. And the very next night, the Japanese sent down two destroyers to do exactly the same thing. And so they felt like they'd failed in what they were. They didn't succeed in teaching the Japanese a lesson by any means. But the within 2 weeks. There was another battle, exactly the same spot, and then another battle and another battle, and there were like four or five battles in exactly the same spot, trying to do exactly the same thing before the Japanese finally realized it was hopeless and started retreating up the chain.
Did you write
this
book?
All the way back to Japan, really. They just retreated from then on.
Did you write this book, Robert, as homage to your dad, to your father?
I wrote, not really. I mean, by the time I realized I was writing a book, I was really just trying to figure it out for myself and my mother, and you know, so I could tell my mother what had happened, and that lasted about a year. And by then, I had so much information that nobody else in the world knew. Then I started thinking maybe I really should be writing this as a book, and that's really how that happened. It was very I went into it kind of hesitantly.
No.
But it's really an homage to all those guys. You know, by the time the book was over, I'd forgotten about my father, sort of, and you know, these other guys were just as important.
Any other books on World War II in the pipeline for you, Robert?
Oh Byer? Boy, I don't know. It's so hard to write a book. It's really exhausting. Maybe. I know so much about it now that I feel like I probably should.
The title, listeners, if you joined us a little bit late, is The Gun Club. The USS Duncan at Cape Esperance off the coast of Guadalcanal by Robert Fowler. He's been our guest here on It's Your Turn for the last few minutes. Robert, nice to meet you. Thanks for chatting with us
today.
Yeah,
you too. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So long now.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick two is 62-62. The pick three, 372-372. The pick four, 9446. The pick five, 36107. Wild ball for each of those is 6. The treasure hunt, 5, 15, 20, 23, and 24. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $25,000.
Did you know that Pennsylvania leads the nation in auto collisions with deer? Not surprising if you live in Butler County. It's obvious that your car and the deer are damaged, but what about you? An impact of only 8 miles per hour is enough to cause soft tissue damage and mild whiplash. If this happens to you, visit Applewood Chiropractic Health and Fitness Center, Thornapple Drive in Butler, for assessment and treatment of acute and chronic whiplash. Learn more online at applewoodchiro.com.
Well, there's still more to come. We have one more topic to discuss here on the Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn. I just glanced out the front window, and it is still so gloomy out there. It is dark, and it's not very warm either. In case you haven't heard the weather forecast, we're looking at some chilly temperatures. We're probably not going to warm up anymore today. It's 37 right now. Wind doesn't seem quite as bad as the weather folks had predicted, but it's still breezy, and it's certainly gloomy. We're looking to drop well down into the 20s tonight, so once again we'll have not just a frost, but a hard freeze, which we had a couple of days ago, and which we certainly had last Saturday. It's also going to be kind of breezy overnight, too, so, boy, be prepared for a cold start to the day on Wednesday. And a high tomorrow, even with partly sunny skies tomorrow, high only in the low 30s. That's 20 degrees below the normal high for this time of year. We should be in the low 50s for the normal high. Wow. And if you think it has to get a little bit better after that, afraid not. Now, the long-range forecast calls for a wintry mix on Thursday and Friday. So maybe some freezing rain and some sleet. Wow, we go from the frying pan into the fire here. We're going to be talking on the final segment of the program today with Mark Olshaker about our war against killer germs. A reminder, though, a program note, coming up tonight, we've got Penguin hockey again as the Penguins are on the road. It's a hockey night in Newark, New Jersey, as the Penguins will face the New Jersey Devils, a team that's been on the skids recently. In fact, they're coming home after a 1-5 road trip. Their only victory coming against the Penguins on Monday night of last week. So we'll see what happens tonight. And we'll have live radio play-by-play for you here on WISR, the Pens and the New Jersey Devils.
Olivia from Washington. Laid off and trying to keep our little kids from realizing that Mommy and Daddy haven't eaten in a while.
Roger from California. I'm grateful we could afford our son's surgery. I'm nervous that now we can't really afford food.
Daniel from California. Choosing whether to pay the rent or pay to fix the car to get to work doesn't leave us with much at all. Now we can't even pay for meals.
Donna from Louisiana. The storm just hit, and we went from donating to the food bank to needing it.
Keisha from South Carolina. I've been skipping meals so my two kids can eat, but filling up on water doesn't really work.
Hunger is a story we can end. End it at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Listeners, welcome on the next segment here on It's Your Turn on WISR. Dave Malarkey is my name. We're going to be speaking by telephone with our next guest. He is Mark Olshaker, one of the co-authors of a fascinating new book, the title of which is Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. First of all, Mark, nice to meet you. Great to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
You are the co-author of this book, along with Dr. Michael Osterholm. Can you tell us a little bit about him, sir?
Yes, he's... Mike is one of the foremost disease detectives in the world. He heads up CIDRAP, the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Development at the University of Minnesota. He is a disease detective par excellence and has been involved in hundreds, if not thousands, of disease outbreak investigations. And what we wanted to do with this book is to try to keep the unthinkable from becoming the inevitable. You know, Dave, we put many billions of dollars a year into national security, yet we're losing sight of the greatest national security threat of all, which is infectious disease, both naturally occurring and bioterror.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, when I first heard about your book, I was interested, number one, because we've just been hearing a lot about the Zika virus. But
sure.
I was totally unprepared when I got the review copy. My goodness, it almost reads like a thriller novel. You've done a good job on this, Mark.
Well, thank you. You know, this is a warning, and in many cases a dire warning of things that people need to know. But it's also a great detective story. These are life and death mysteries, and we want people to be caught up in the high scientific drama as well.
So what about Zika? That's been the most recent, and actually that probably goes back to late summer as we were getting ready for the Olympic Games down
sure.
in Rio de Janeiro. It seems to have tapered off, at least the news has. I'm not sure about the disease itself.
Yeah, the news has, but we're still seeing it's still a mystery to us. We know about the microcephaly and other birth defect problems, but we're still learning about it. We don't really know all of the effects and what's going to happen. And the fascinating thing is that Zika has been known since 1947, but it was a relatively benign disease until about 6 or 7 years ago, when crossing the Pacific Ocean, it seems to have mutated. And this is one of the primary themes of infectious disease, which is we as human beings, we reproduce each generation about every 25, 30 years. These microbes, the viruses and bacteria, they reproduce every 20 minutes. And each one of those reproductive cycles is a new spin of the genetic roulette wheel. So there are many more microbes than there are humans, so we really do have a war on our hands, and this is national security of the most existential kind.
You detail in your book, I'm speeding on here because of our time limitations,
sure.
You detail some of the history, which I found fascinating, because we've been successful in the past, in past decades, malaria, AIDS, TB, among others, right?
We have, but we're in danger of losing ground on all of them. I mean, we have what we call our crisis agenda, which is the priority list of what's most important for our security and survival. At the top of that list is a worldwide pandemic, primarily influenza of the type that devastated the world in 1918. And frankly, even though we've got 100 years' worth of scientific and technological advancement since then, we're actually in worse shape for that kind of devastating problem than we were 100 years ago. And 100 years ago, it killed 100 million people. And then the next thing on the list is antibiotic resistance. We are in danger of going back to the pre-antibiotic era, which would essentially make medicine primitive again.
This is because of the overuse, when sometimes not necessary, of antibiotics?
Absolutely. It's that. I mean, bacteria have a natural tendency to build resistance, but we've got to slow that down, and at the same time, we've got to find new antibiotics. You know, you and I, we buy antibiotics when we need them in those little orange plastic bottles from the pharmacy. Agriculture, using them for food animals, they buy them by the ton, by the truckload. And so 60 to 70% of all the antibiotic use in the world is for animals. Primarily, we have it in the United States, although it's going down. But India and China are both huge offenders. And, you know, this is a worldwide issue. If we suddenly were attacked by aliens, I think all of the world's problems would go away in terms of differences in religion, in political philosophy, in nationality. And this is an alien invasion, essentially. It's us against the microbes, and they can outmaneuver us in many ways. So we've got to outthink them and use our resources.
One of the things that we're battling is the way that diseases are transmitted, sometimes through personal contact, sometimes through sexual mm-hmm. contact. And we also have mosquitoes and bugs that are a huge public health concern.
You,
right?
You've hit the nail on the head, Dave. We call the mosquito public enemy number one. Zika, dengue, yellow fever. We're seeing a huge yellow fever outbreak in Brazil now, and it could easily come to American cities. It's been a rural disease up until now, and you know, we thought we'd taken care of that 100 years ago, but our mosquito control is so lax now that it's coming back. And along with climate change, mosquitoes are in more and more areas that they never used to be.
Another thing that's relatively new, it's spreading rapidly, it's Lyme disease due mainly mm-hmm. to ticks. I know when the kids in my family had three siblings, we played out in the woods all the time.
So did we, sure.
You wouldn't dare do that. I mean, we never knew what a tick was. We never thought about ticks. You can't do that today, though.
Absolutely right. And we're just not paying the attention that we need to. This is the greatest war any of us are ever going to fight, and we've got to think of this as national security.
One of your chapters, and I love the title, Vaccines, : the sharpest arrow in our quiver. And yet in some quarters, there's still a little bit of controversy about that, isn't there?
There certainly is, and I would say in many cases that controversy is fomented by people who've never experienced the time before vaccines, when diseases that we now give childhood immunizations for were rampant and killers. Now, having said that, not all vaccines are equal. The childhood immunization vaccines that we give should not be controversial. They are very safe. Dr. Osterholm makes sure that each of his grandchildren get them appropriately. On the other hand, our influenza vaccine is less than 50% effective, and we've been lulled into thinking that that's enough. What we really need to do, Dave, is to spend and use our scientific resources to come up with what we call a game-changing influenza vaccine that could really take a kind of 1918 flu off the table. If we could achieve that, and the science is there to do it, we would save more lives than, you know, all the wars we could anticipate. We would save more lives than all the lives that have been saved in American emergency rooms in the 20th and 21st centuries.
As you talk about influenza or the flu, I'm thinking back to a comment you made just a few minutes ago about how so many of these viruses and bugs mutate. That seems to be the problem with flu, right? Because the vaccine has to be reformulated every year.
Well, and the reformulation is just a guess. I mean, the simple fact is a virus like that, not to get too technical, but an RNA-based virus, the virus that goes into your body is not necessarily the same one that comes out. It can mutate in there. And influenza is basically an avian, a bird disease that gets mixed with humans. Humans and birds mix these microbes very easily. And then when you add pigs to the situation, and there's a lot of cases agriculturally where we have humans, pigs, and poultry living in very close confines, the lungs of a pig are a perfect mixing bowl for human and avian strains. And, you know, most of the time what comes out will be fairly benign. But every once in a while, you'll get a 1918 type strain, and you know there will be hell to pay. Right now, in Southeast Asia, there's a strain circulating called H7N9, and in our book, Deadliest Enemy, we have a scenario of what would happen if a disease like H7N9 took hold of the world. And I can tell you, that scenario reads like, you know, the worst horror story you could imagine.
RNA. My goodness, I haven't heard that term since my AP biology. ribonucleic acid, right?
You got it. Yeah? You got it.
And I only got a B in that course, too.
I won't tell you what I got in chemistry, but Mike did much better.
Listen, our time, this is a very, very fascinating book. Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. Is the book available, Mark?
The book is available now. You can get it at your local bookstore, at Barnes & Noble. You can get it on Amazon, anywhere you like. And we just feel these are things that the average citizen has to know, and it's also a great scientific adventure story, we hope.
Mark Olshaker, co-author, along with Dr. Michael Osterholm, of Deadliest Enemy. Thanks, Mark. Nice to talk with you today.
Thank you, Dave. You've been a great host.
Thanks very much.
It's never been more important to stay in touch with the events and issues that shape our world. And for more than 25 years, Radio Pennsylvania has been the Commonwealth's source for stories and newsmakers impacting your life.
We're taking precautions to prepare for the worst that this storm can deliver.
And I believe that we need an armed, highly trained security officer in every school.
We should not be using mental illness as a scapegoat for things like mass shootings and violence.
Covering your state capital and all corners of the Commonwealth, Radio PA's team of award-winning journalists is on constant watch as your eyes and ears on the front lines of the major events of our time. Honored for broadcasting and journalistic excellence by
the Associated Press, the Pennsylvania Association of Broadcasters, the National Association of State Radio Networks, the National Headliner Awards, and many others.
Eight-time winner of the Joe Snyder Award for Outstanding News Service, the top news honor bestowed by the Associated Press in Pennsylvania. The Radio Pennsylvania Network, bringing you closer to Harrisburg and all of your Keystone State.
Butler County wakes up with Dave weekdays from 5:30 to 9 on WISR 680 AM Butler.